Hello, and welcome to this week's Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History, your host for today's program. Beginning as we usually do, looking back at this week in history, we would recall that on May 12, 1978, the U.S. Commerce Department announced that it would discontinue the practice of naming hurricanes solely after women. On May 13, 1981, Pope John Paul II suffered serious injuries after Turkish gunman Mehmet Ali Gaca made an attempt on his life in St. Peter's Square, the Vatican. On May 16, 1929, the first Academy Award celebration was held in Hollywood's Roosevelt Hotel. And on May 17, 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court declared segregated schools inherently unequal in the case named Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas. Reporting on history that has made the news lately, ancient cypress trees growing in the swamps of Tidewater, Virginia, and North Carolina have convinced some historians that severe weather wiped out the first British settlement in America. The lost colony of Roanoke, founded in 1587 by 120 English men and women, had by 1590 completely vanished, you'll recall, leaving only the name of a local Indian tribe scratched into the side of a tree. Now historians believe a drought, the worst in 800 years, explains the fate of the colony. Lacking sufficient rain and subdued by the searing summer sun, they believe the colonists at Roanoke could do little to stave off exhaustion, starvation, and ultimately the extinction of their settlement. The remains of the settlers, however, have never been located. A collection of recently released Pentagon documents is raising new questions about the military's involvement in the civil rights movement of the 1960s. The hundreds of pages of intelligence reports reveal that U.S. military agents secretly infiltrated civil rights organizations and engaged in surveillance of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights leaders. The question remains, why? While current Pentagon officials are reluctant to explain, civil rights leaders charged that the surveillance was an attempt to discredit Dr. King, who had become increasingly vocal in his opposition to the war in Vietnam. For our principal segment today, I'm pleased to welcome Robert Hopkins, Creighton historian, who will be talking to Rashid Khalidi of the University of Chicago on the 50th anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel. Robert?
Thank you. Few countries in the world today engender the strong emotions that arise when one talks about Israel. To some, the small Jewish homeland is a symbol of religious hope and salvation, the dream of a people come true. To others, Israel is a democratic bulwark against autocratic regimes in a region of crucial global importance. To yet others, Israel is a conqueror, an oppressor that has stolen land and hope from a people forced into an international no-man's land. Hardly a week passes when we are not deluged in the news with some new crisis or tragedy either in or involving Israel. May 14th marks the 50th anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel and provides us with an opportunity to look back at the history of this highly controversial state, as well as to look ahead to forecast its long-term historical legacy. Our guest today is Professor Rashid Khalidi of the University of Chicago. Among his most recent publications is the book Palestinian Identity, The Construction of Modern National Consciousness, published by Columbia University Press. Welcome, Professor Khalidi.
Thank you.
One of the questions that first comes to mind is, now here in 1998, is this the sort of Israel, is this the Middle East that David Ben-Gurion and others might have envisaged 50 years ago when they first founded the Israeli state?
Well, that's a very hard question because, on the one hand, the Israel that they envisaged, I think, was inward-looking in the sense of looking at the Jewish citizens of the state to be. And outward-looking in the sense that it looked to the diaspora and the rest of the world, but not very attentive to its environment. In other words, the ways in which Israel would come to terms with its Arab environment, given the fact that there had been conflict in the years leading up to the establishment of Israel, I don't think was something that Israeli leaders spent a whole lot of time worrying about. They had other worries, they had other concerns, and even though I wouldn't say that the conflict was far from their minds, it was in the front of their minds in some senses, I don't think they gave a lot of thought to how are we going to reconcile with our Arab neighbors. And a lot of the recent research by Israeli historians into the immediate post-1948 war period shows that Ben-Gurion in many cases preferred other things to peace. He was not willing to make a series of concessions like allowing refugee return or territorial compromises, which might have achieved peace with some of the Arab countries around Israel. He preferred to keep the land and keep the refugees out to the kind of peace that might have resulted. So I think the kind of future that Israel looked towards in 1948 and what we have today, or I should put it differently, what we have today in some ways is a logical outcome of the fact that that Israeli leaders at that time didn't pay perhaps as much attention as they might have to this issue of Israel coming to terms with its environment.
Would you say then perhaps that Israel was based on the issue of no compromise and unwillingness to recognize these differences?
I wouldn't put it that way. I think Israel and Zionism grow out of a European context, a European context of anti-Semitism, a European context of oppression and persecution, and sort of absolute conclusions that are drawn from that. You must have a state of a certain sort. You cannot have a large Arab population. You must be completely independent of your environment. In other words, there were powerful categorical imperatives that drove the founders of the state, and which have been used ever since as justifications for some of that state's practices by its defenders. That is to say, in other words, that as far as they are concerned, the Jewish history as they read it determined the need for this, that, and the other. In some cases that meant no compromise, for example, on the issue of refugee return, because what was at issue for them was not so much the purity of the state, but the fact that they wanted a Jewish state. The whole idea of Zionism was not to come to yet another country where Jews would be a minority. The problem is that they wanted to create a Jewish state in a country which in 1948 had a large Arab majority. And that was the result of, and that resulted in the expulsion of Palestinians, because you couldn't have a Jewish state in an Arab country unless some of the Arabs were forced to leave.
And when you say that these were largely European ideas about state, would you say that that raises one of the problems facing Israel today, is identifying itself as either a European Jewish heritage or a Middle Eastern Jewish heritage, and how those two things are different actively affects its negotiations, its environment then with the indigenous peoples of the region? Is that fair?
Well, some Israelis would go even further than that and say that that applies as well to the relationship between Israelis of European backgrounds and Israelis of non-European backgrounds. But I think that that's true. Israel is a response to a European Jewish problem. The Jewish problem, as it was seen at the time, in some senses was talked about as a universal condition. But you do not have pogroms. You do not have the kind of constant religiously based persecution in the Islamic world, in the Middle East, of Jews that you had in Christian Europe throughout history. And certainly you don't have anything on the order of the horrible pogroms that occurred in the Tsarist Empire around the turn of this century, and nothing like the monstrosity of the Holocaust. These are European Jewish issues. This is the ultimate outcome of European Jewish history, and Zionism is a response by European Jews to a European Jewish problem. There are no Yemeni Jewish Zionist leaders in 1910. There are no Moroccan or Egyptian or Iraqi Zionist leaders in 1920 or 1930 or 1940. They're all Europeans, without exception, without a single exception. The entirety of the Zionist movement, body and soul, leaders and followers, in the first few decades from Herzl onward, are Europeans who are choosing Zionism as a response to a European problem. And as a result, whatever the ethnic composition of the Israeli state, its ideology and its cultural orientation were very much Western.
Does this raise the specter that a European problem, a European crisis like Israel in the Middle East could never be reconciled, that there is no historical potential for a peaceful resolution?
Well, I'm not sure the one thing necessarily follows from the other, but there is clearly a problem here. Israelis and Western Jews, many Israelis at least, and most Western Jews, see Israel in the context of a narrative of Jewish history, which starts with the fall of the temple and ends with the Holocaust, and in which Israel involves a redemption of of Jewish peoplehood after all of those centuries of that people not having a state, and after the horrors of the Holocaust. That narrative doesn't leave any room for an Arab country in which this new Jewish state is being established, or for 1,400,000 Arabs who lived there in 1948, half of whom were made refugees by the creation of Israel. You have to have some way, if there's going to be a reconciliation of Israel with its environment and peace between Arabs and Israelis, you have to have some way of bringing those two narratives, one, a Palestinian Arab narrative of, you know, Palestinians living in their country and colonists coming from Europe, and the other, a narrative of Jewish history which ends with the creation of Israel, into some kind of a relationship with one another. At the moment, they're completely separate. In the West, the hegemonic narrative, as we know, is the Israeli narrative. I mean, people see things in terms of Israel. They don't see things in terms of the Palestinians. The Palestinians are not really seen by some people as even existing or as having a full legitimacy, whereas Israel is grudgingly in some cases and joyously in other cases seen as, you know, the focus of the focus of the whole story. So I think that there has to be some way of bringing those two things into relationship with one another, and in particular of Israelis seeing how their history has to be reconciled with the history of the region, and also of Palestinians and Arabs coming to have some understanding of how Jewish history, and in particular Jewish history in Europe leading up to the Holocaust, led to and justified and explained Zionism.
Are those reasonable expectations? Do you think there's a historical potential for those problems to be addressed in anything other than a 1948, a 1956, a 1967, a 1973, all of these violent conflicts and clashes?
It's possible. It's not going to be easy. The major conflicts have been resolved in the past. I mean, France and Germany were at war twice. World wars brought the whole world into catastrophic conflict in the century, and they are now reconciled. Their national narratives, they don't fight over Charlemagne, and they don't fight over Alsace-Lorraine, and they don't fight over issues that were quite emotionally important to both peoples. I think it's possible. It's not going to be easy, because these are deeply emotional issues which people now alive remember as if they were yesterday. I mean, there are many Holocaust survivors. There are many Palestinians who themselves personally were made refugees in 1948. There are many people who understand their own history of the last 50, 60, 75 years in terms of their own lives. So it will be hard.
So then is it fair to say perhaps that the issue about Israel, the heritage of Israel, is more about emotional, intangible, perhaps religious issues than it is about our traditional understanding of state conflicts, territorial aggrandizement, natural resources, border disputes, things like that?
It involves both, I think. I think there is a very important emotional, psychological, ideological, religious even element to the conflict, but there is also certainly issues. There are also certainly issues of interests, state interests, borders, security, resources, and so forth. In this country, I think there's much more focus on the first set of things than there is in the Middle East. In the Middle East, people have grudgingly, more or less, begun to come to terms with some of the differences. Not everybody, but many people have come to terms with the differences and see, in emotional and ideological terms, and see this now as mainly an issue of security, number of kilometers of territory here, control of water, and so forth. In this country, there's a lot of emotionalism about the subject, however, perhaps for understandable reasons, perhaps because of guilt that the people who are profoundly supportive of Israel are sitting here in comfort and Israelis are out there in Israel. Whatever the reasons may be, you have a lot more heat than light on many of these subjects here, which relate to the emotionalism. That's not to say that Israelis are not emotional or Arabs are not emotional, and that there's not a lot of ideological and religious and other static there. But I think that a lot more of it there is a concern with traditional state-to-state issues.
Does that affect the issue over Israel usurping the Palestinian land, considering that in 1948 there was not, as we know it in the West today, a state of Palestine?
No, but there was supposed to be a state of Palestine according to the partition resolution which established the state of Israel. There wasn't a state of Israel either before 1948, and that state owed its international legitimacy, at least in some measure, to a partition resolution passed by the General Assembly in November of 1947, which called for the creation of an Arab state. The difference was that the yeshuv, the Jewish community in Palestine, was both strong enough internally and powerful enough militarily and well-supported enough internationally to establish the state that was called for, whereas the Palestinians were neither strong enough nor well enough supported to do what they were supposed to have been able to do according to the same resolution. So there wasn't a state of Palestine or a state of Israel. There were supposed to be both, but only one was created in 1948, and that had mostly to do with the balance of forces on the ground at the time. Even before it was a state, the Israeli, the nascent Israeli polity was stronger. The issue of the Jewish community in Palestine was considerably stronger than the much more numerous Palestinian Arab community.
So would you say, as we look back on the 50th anniversary of Israel, that its greatest legacy perhaps is the Palestinian diaspora? And perhaps what is it that scholars could or should do to help us better understand not only the history of the region, but to help foster peace in the Middle East?
Well, I don't think many Israelis would say that Israel's greatest legacy is the Palestinian diaspora. I think Israelis would be offended by that. Palestinians would say that because, from a Palestinian point of view, the joyous narrative of redemption after the Holocaust is secondary to the destruction of Palestinian Arab society by the 1948 war. I think the point is that both sides have to understand that both things happened at the same time. This was not a jubilee celebration of redemption for everybody. For one people, it meant the destruction of their hopes of independent national existence, and for the other, it meant the fulfillment of those hopes. And both things happened at the same time, and one happened because the other happened. They were related. They weren't two things happening on different sides of the globe. They happened in the same place and as a result of the same processes. And I don't think that you're going to have be able to reconcile the two peoples until they can both understand both of these things happening. It's very hard for Arabs to see, or Palestinians in particular, to see, for example, that an event that devastated them, that destroyed them, that personally affected the lives of almost every single Palestinian unto the third generation until today, 1998, was something which was a source of great joy to people who survived World War II. Similarly, it's very hard for Israelis to understand that an event which for them is the most important milestone in their modern history is a source of continuing grief to this day for Palestinians. Both are going to have to figure that out before I think we can have any kind of hope of real reconciliation.
Well, then I'll take that as a good recommendation for future scholarship and future teaching and education. Well, Professor Khalidi, it's been a great pleasure to chat with you today. Again, ladies and gentlemen, we've been chatting with Professor Rashid Khalidi from the University of Chicago. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. And in keeping with this week's show on the 50th anniversary of Israel, the historical site of the week is the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. Founded in 1965, the museum provides a unique view into the past and present material culture of the land of Israel and its people. With over 500,000 square feet of ancient and contemporary exhibits and a 5-acre sculpture garden, the museum is a cultural centerpiece in the year-long celebration of Israel's founding. For more information, search the web at www.infotour.co.il. This week's radio op-ed piece continues our focus on the 50th anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel. Alan Steinwise, Associate Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln and Director of the University's Harris Center for Judaic Studies, offers his thoughts on the subject.
As we commemorate the 50th anniversary of the founding of the modern State of Israel, we need to contemplate the world historical significance of that event. Preoccupied as we are by important debates over security, refugees, water rights, and the like, it is easy to lose sight of how truly remarkable and historically unique a story the rebirth of Israel has been. Consider the following. The Jews, dispossessed of their homeland by a conquering empire and dispersed across great distances, maintained their spiritual connection to that land for two millennia. In preparing a return to their homeland, they created a new Jewish culture with a new language, modern Hebrew, as its centerpiece. They reestablished and secured their homeland in the face of overwhelming opposition by a constellation of forces around the globe which would deny to the Jewish people the right to self-determination that is assumed a given for all others. Within a half century, the new state has achieved a high level of educational, technological, and economic achievement. It is militarily strong, despite the fact that it is tiny and is the object of persistent hostility from many of its neighbors. The state is a democracy in which members of ethnic and religious minorities enjoy basic rights, vote, and sit in the parliament. In some circles, including the academic ones in which I spend much of my time, admiration for the state of Israel has not been especially fashionable in recent years. Israel is often seen as a vestige of Western colonialism and as an oppressor of the Palestinians. People who hold this view seem unable to recognize that Israel embodies the national liberation of a long-suffering people. This cannot be simply the result of ignorance about Jewish history. All educated people are familiar with the main contours of the Jewish past, and certainly with the Holocaust. So what accounts for the hostility to Israel? My own opinion is that it reflects a failure to adapt to the reality of Jewish strength. Many people feel comfortable with Jews only in the role of the underdog, the victim. To them, the success story of modern Israel produces cognitive dissonance. Israel's very success is a source of psychological discomfort. So they fixate on Israel's sins, both real and imagined. To be sure, Israel is not a perfect country. It does have serious problems. Most notably, it is divided internally over issues of religion, and it has not yet devised a way to secure its own future without depriving the Palestinians of their self-determination. But when we are confronted by those who accentuate the negative while ignoring Israel's accomplishments, we should respond with a simple question. What other country has established so open a society, so vibrant a democracy, against such overwhelming odds in so short a time?
You've been listening to Alan Steinweis, historian and director of the University of Nebraska's Harris Center for Judaic Studies.
אביב חריף תלוי קיים וריח אורנים ניסה ברוח הארבעים עם כל פעמונים ותר במטילן ואבן שבויה בחלומה.
And finally, we have our weekly listing of coming attractions, a segment in which we call to your attention upcoming films, television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else related to history that might interest you. This week, we'd recommend the History Channel's broadcast of The Knights Templar on Thursday, May 14th. The one-hour show will explore the mystery of those men who, entrusted with the duty of protecting Christians on pilgrimages to the Holy Land in the 12th century, just after the completion of the First Crusade, were later accused of worshiping the devil. Check your local listings for detailed broadcast information. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our show. As always, if you have any comments to offer, questions to raise, topics to suggest for future programs, please send them to us either by email at talkinghistory, all one word, at creighton.edu, or send by regular mail to the address Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, from Creighton University, this is Brian Laveau.
Ita kabah.